say the first canto, I want to make a monumental announcement to Pratyahari Prabhu and his team, including Nimai Pandit Prabhu, Arjuna Prabhu, and Nanda Kumar Prabhu, have completed a nearly completed draft of the survey course of this entire Srimad Bhagavatam. That will be our curriculum for next year's two-semester course. And it covers all 12 cantos in a thematic way. In other words, the themes will be pulled from various parts of the Bhagavatam to deal with it in a very sequential and systematic way. Instead of going chronologically through first through 12 cantos, we'll be going on a series of topics, topically. And it's very brilliant, and it's going to be a very interesting study. So I want to thank Brajahari Prabhu, who has just completed this after working on it for the last two semesters, and Nimai Pandit Prabhu especially. It is a huge task. How do you feel after finishing? You learned a lot, yeah. So we have 160 classes, none of which are even slightly repetitious. So this morning's verses are the 24th and 25th verses of the 18th chapter, first canto, 321 in this book. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Saraswatim Vyasam. Tato Jayam Udirayan. Nasta Prayeshva Bhadreshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavati Uttama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtaki. Let's do the synonyms first, please. Let's just read them in unison. Ekada, once upon a time, Tanu, Eros, and Bor, Udyamya, taking firmly, Vicharam, following, Mrigayam, hunting excursion, Vane, in the forest, Mrigan, stags, Anugataha, while following, Shanta, fatigue, Shudhita, hungry, Trishita, being thirsty, Brisham, extremely, Jala Ashayam, reservoir of water, Achakshanam, while searching for, Ravivesha, entered into, Tam, that famous, Ashramam, hermitage of Samaka Rishi, Munim, the sage, Asinam, Tantam, all silent, Nilita, closed, Lodshanam, eyes. Ekada dhana udyamya.
Ekada dhana udyamya.
Vicharan mrigayam bane.
Vicharan mrigayam bane.
Mrigan anugata shranta.
Mrigan anugata shranta.
Shudhitas trishito brisham.
Shudhitas trishito brisham.
Let's just do the first verse, please. Ekada dhana udyamya.
Ekada dhana udyamya.
Vicharan mrigayam bane.
Vicharan mrigayam bane.
Mrigan anugatak shanta.
Mrigan anugatak
shranta. Shuditas trishito brisham.
Shuditas trishito brisham.
Ekada dhanur udyamya.
Ekada dhanur udyamya.
Vicharan mrigayam bane.
Vicharan mrigayam bane.
Mrigan anugata shranta.
Mrigan anugata shranta.
Shudhitas trishito brisham.
Shudhitas trishito brisham.
Please chant. Ekada dhanur udyamya.
Vicharan mrigayam bane. shanta shrita shrita vrijam ekada dhanur udyamya pracharan mrigayam vane Prajan Anugata Shanta Shutita Srishito Vrisham Ekada Dhanu Udyamya Pracharan Vrigayam Vane Prajan Anugata Shanta Shudhitas Krishito Brisham Ekadatam Udyamya Vicharam Vrayamane Rekadatam Udyatas Shanta Shudhitas Krishito Brisham Ekadatam Udyamya Vijayam Vijayam Vane Vrijyan Anugata Shanta Shuditas Trishito Brisham.
Anyone else?
Ekadadhanu Udyamya Vijayam Vijayam Vane Gita Shanta Shrita Shrita Krishnam.
Okay. Srila Prabhupada's translation and purport. We have working microphones this morning. Please, Brandon, would you like to read?
Yes.
Is it working?
Are you translating?
Please. Yes.
Once upon a time, Maharaj Parikshit, while engaged in hunting in the forest with bow and arrows, became extremely fatigued, hungry and thirsty while following the stags. While searching for a reservoir of water, he entered the hermitage of the well-known Shamika Rishi and saw the sage sitting silently with closed eyes.
Report. The Supreme Lord is so kind to his pure devotee that in proper time he calls such devotees up to him and thus creates an auspicious circumstance for the devotee. Maharaj Parikshit was a pure devotee of the Lord, and there was no reason for him to become extremely fatigued, hungry, and thirsty because a devotee of the Lord never becomes perturbed by such bodily demands. By the desire of the Lord, even such a devotee can become apparently fatigued and thirsty just to create a situation favorable for his renunciation of worldly activities. One has to give up all attachment for worldly relations before one is able to go back to Godhead, and thus, when a devotee is too much absorbed in worldly affairs, the Lord creates a situation to cause indifference. The Supreme Lord never forgets his pure devotee, even though he may be engaged in so-called worldly affairs.
Sometimes he creates an awkward situation, and the devotee becomes obliged to renounce all worldly affairs. The devotee can understand by the signal of the Lord, but others take it to be unfavorable and frustrating. Maharaj Parikshit was to become the medium of the revelation of Srimad Bhagavatam by Lord Sri Krishna, as his grandfather Arjuna was the medium for the Bhagavad Gita. Had Arjuna not been taken up with an illusion of family affection by the will of the Lord, the Bhagavad Gita would not have been spoken by the Lord himself for the good of all concerned. Similarly, had Maharaj Parikshit not been fatigued, hungry and thirsty at this time, Srimad Bhagavatam would not have been spoken by Srila Shukadev Goswami, the prime authority of Srimad Bhagavatam.
So this is a prelude to the circumstances under which Srimad Bhagavatam was spoken for the benefit of all concerned. The prelude, therefore, begins with the words, Once upon a time.
Srila Prabhupada Gita. So when you hear once upon a time, what do you think? It's a fairy tale, yes. Here is some kind of a fictional story. Long, long ago in a universe far, far away. So Ekada means once upon a time. And here Shonaka Rishi is beginning the answer to the sage's question about how Parikshit Maharaj came to hear Srimad Bhagavatam. This question was asked a long time ago, and it was taken many chapters and many months for us to come to this point. So now that we have all of the background, we know who Maharaj Parikshit is, how his, he was protected by the Lord in the womb, etc. Now he has this final incident prior to his meeting Sukadeva Goswami is being described. So the previous verse, I'd just like to read the translation again. It's so beautiful. O rishis, who are so powerfully pure as the sun, I shall try to describe to you the transcendental pastimes of Vishnu as far as my knowledge is concerned. As the birds fly in the sky as far as their capacity allows, so do the learned devotees describe the Lord as far as their realization allows. So it is not a question of being able to describe Krishna in any comprehensive way, but just as far as one's realization allows. To that extent, one can talk about the Lord. So these pastimes are sometimes very difficult to believe. They are very difficult to affirm with our rational senses. We discussed in a previous class about, is faith ever reasonable? Some of you may remember. What is the word, what is the term for how you get your knowledge? Yes, epistemology. So our epistemology in Krishna consciousness is based on which method? The descending, right. Avarohaha Panth, is that correct? The descending method. So we take knowledge from a higher source. In London in 1969, the devotees rented a big hall in central London, Conway Hall, for some lectures by Srila Prabhupada. And one of them was on this subject. I believe the first one, in fact. And this is the introduction to the Sri Ishopanishad, called the Teachings of the Vedas. So in that lecture, Srila Prabhupada discusses the infallible nature of descending knowledge. He gives the example of cow dung. The general understanding of dung of any animal is that it's impure. But the Shastra says that cow dung is pure. And science has affirmed that it's full of ammonia, isn't it? And ammonia, ammonia is the antiseptic property that is prominent in cow dung. So, therefore, it's used for cleaning things. What to speak of being impure? It's used to make impure places pure. So, similarly, he said the bone of an animal is impure, but when we take a conch shell, as they would say in Key West, conch shell, then it is not only pure, it's offered to the Lord in Arti. So in this way, even apparent contradictions are rectified by the power of the authority of the Vedas. So the point is that not by our own perceptions can we ascertain things as they are, but by hearing from a higher authority. Now, this is something that is entirely experiential. It is not to be expected that somebody's going to believe in Krishna consciousness, believe in Srimad Bhagavatam, just on the basis of a decision, a mental decision. Okay, now I believe in this. See, it's not possible because the contents are so contradictory to our mental and sensual perceptions that nobody can just direct their minds to believe in it. But what makes it possible, or let me ask you, what makes it possible for reasonably intelligent people, like some of us here, to, as the legal term is, prima facie, on the surface of the thing, accept the pastimes in Srimad Bhagavatam? What makes it possible? Anyone like to say? Really? Yeah, it's very good. Yes, Lord Chaitanya said, Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhu Kabunoi Shravanade Sudhi Chite Karaya Udoi. That love of Krishna is not something to be introduced from an outside source, but it is awakened in the heart by hearing and chanting. And similarly, Prahlad Maharaj has said that Nate vidu swarti gatim yuvishnu, is that the verse? It is not by, you cannot understand God by committees, by meetings. Matirna Krishna. Yes, so Parato Svatova. The ordinary person, Prahlad Maharaj said, is very committed to materialistic point of view. Very committed, with great faith. There is great faith that by pursuing material enjoyment, you'll become happy. And that is a result of not of experience and not of higher authority, but just kind of a herd mentality that everybody else is doing it. And this is what you do. This is what life is all about. Grihavratanam. Very, very great determination to enjoy life materially. So there is an epistemology separate from Krishna consciousness. It sometimes looks, because people look at devotees and say, well, you believe in something. You know, you're religious fanatics. You've taken some faith and you believe it. For some reason, you're such a loser in your life that you just have to glom onto this faith and, you know, and believe. So this is how the materialist will see somebody who's having a spiritual experience. Because as I was saying, it's not possible to believe in the incredible pastimes found in Srimad Bhagavatam mentally or theoretically. It is only, but on the other hand, they become as real as anything and relishable and sweet because our love of Krishna is awakening through the process of bhakti, hearing and chanting. See, that is like eating. Nobody has to tell you this is a very nice dish. You know, now you're enjoying this. when it tastes good, you're relishing it, and you have complete knowledge and realization and faith. one of the five most important facets of experiencing bhakti yoga is sadhu sangha. So in the association of other people who are having similar experiences, our own experiences become magnified. So it's also easier to enhance our experience by sharing them with other people who understand what in the world you're talking about. If you want an example, just go home for Christmas break and try to explain your experience to your family members. Has anyone ever tried this? What was your experience? Ananta. Has anyone other than Ananta, who is a pure devotee, born in a family of pure devotees, had this experience? What was it like?
There's a big difference between my mom and my dad. My mom's a lot more open-minded, and she's experienced kirtan. You know, she's been a lot more open to kirtan and just kind of getting into it. Whereas my dad, he hasn't taken the step of kind of just throwing himself into the chanting and like just kind of experiencing just the chanting for what it is, just the chanting. So I notice a big difference when I try to explain my experience with chanting, that my mom will understand it and my dad won't. It seems like just based on their experiences, that's why they do or don't.
Uh-huh. So it's experiential, and this is my point. Once we experience the taste of Krishna consciousness, then it's very easy to appreciate what we're reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, right? But without that taste, it's just Greek. It's unfathomable to the average person. So that is the unique quality of devotional service and of the Srimad Bhagavatam. There are purposes for fairy tales. They are meant to illustrate a story, to entertain, to maybe make a moral point. There is an equivalent in the Vedic lexicon called the Hit Upadesh, right, which are stories of various talking animals and other personalities, which are essentially moral lessons, moral and practical lessons. For example, there's this, the story of the moose and the jackal. So the jackal is walking along the field one day and steps over a blind well. The well has been overgrown on the top, falls to the bottom of this dry well, and he's stuck, can't get up the sides, they're too steep. So he starts singing very loudly. And before long, a moose comes over and peers down. What are you doing down there? He says, oh, I'm dancing, it's a party, it's very nice, you should come and join. So the foolish moose jumps in, and the jackal jumps on the moose's antlers and jumps out of the well. Stories like that, where the monkey and the crocodile, right, that famous story, it's very appropriate for the University of Florida. The monkey and the crocodile were perennial enemies. And so one day the crocodile swam up to the monkey's tree on the bank of the lake and said, my friend, we've been fighting for so long. Why don't we have a truce? I'd like to be your friend. And the monkey very willingly said, thank you, that sounds great. He said, wonderful. My friend, let me invite you to my house for lunch today. He said, but you live in the middle of the lake. How will I get there? Oh, it's no problem. I'll give you a ride on my back. So the monkey jumped down and jumped on the alligator's back and was swimming off to the middle of the lake. Then the monkey started getting nervous. And he asked the alligator, what are we having for lunch today? And the alligator said, we are having heart of monkey. So the monkey very cleverly replied, oh, my friend, you should have told me. I left my heart back in the tree. So the alligator turned around. They could just take me back and I'll go get it so we can have lunch. So the foolish alligator turned around, and of course the monkey hopped off, and that was the end of that. So the moral of that story is you can make friends with someone, but don't give your heart easily. Yeah. So in this way, Hit Upadesh has all of these kind of fairy tale-ish stories. But then we read in Srimad Bhagavatam a great variety of pastimes. This particular pastime with King Parikshit and Shamika Rishi, it's a very understandable and relatable human experience involving anger and immaturity and forgiveness and tolerance. And we'll be reading this in the next few days. So this one is not so hard to swallow. But some of the other episodes from Srimad Bhagavatam, such as Dhruva Maharaj and the Yakshas in the fourth canto, or so many of them, even Parikshit Maharaj's earlier leelas, being saved in the womb by Lord Krishna, meeting the cow and the bull, the Dharma personified and the earth personified. You know, these things sound like fairy tales. So do we take them literally or do we take them figuratively? Unless they're specifically said to be allegories, they're meant to be taken literally. So how is that possible? It's completely beyond the realm of our ability to understand. And this, of course, is where we take the Bhagavatam as an absolute authority. Our epistemology is that we do not trust our minds and senses. We trust in higher sources of knowledge. And why do we trust them? Because it's been so much damn fun. Giving up the slavery to our mind and senses and experiencing a transcendental life. So in the third canto, Lord Kapila Dev describes this. What is the verse? Sadhu Sangha. Satam, good association. Satam prasangam, mama virya sambhido. In the good association of Vaishnavas, mama virya sambhido, we hear about the glorious, incredible pastimes of the Lord. Bhavanti hrit karna rasayana kata. And then this becomes very pleasing to the heart. It's like nectar They're relishable. Like hearing about Lord Varaha. You know, God is a pig? Who would believe such a thing? Yes, this is our God. He is a boar, a giant boar. You know. But then hearing about Lord Varaha's pastimes, his chivalry with Hiranyaksha, his incredible prowess, his appearing from the nostril of Lord Brahma. Nobody could write this stuff. You know? But Jiva Goswami explains that the first principle of theism is accepting the inconceivable nature of God. What do we think God would be doing? You know, going on Facebook? Trying to, you know, make friends with somebody on Facebook? The more amazing the pastime, the more believable it is. See? So, these talks are very sweet. Rasayana Kata. Tad Joshanadash Apavarga Vartmani. And the effect of hearing them, which is very profound, and not just a matter of faith, but profoundly changes our lives and our consciousness, is that it takes us forward on the path of spiritual advancement. Without this taste, to try to give up bad habits, for example, is a teeth-gritting and frustrating experience. It's all based on willpower. But in the association of devotees, the sweet taste of Krishna's pastimes makes it easy to forget about material life. You know, that is the unique quality of these pastimes. Tajoshanat ash apavarga vartmani, opening up the path to liberation. And then, shraddha, ratir, bhakti, anukramisyati. Three things follow in quick succession. Shraddha, which is faith. Rati, attraction, right, and bhakti, yes, devotion. Faith, taste, and devotion follow automatically. So when something happens automatically, it's considered very high tech, it's considered very efficient, modern, and well thought out. So the science of bhakti is like that. Once we get a taste for bhakti, and we get a taste for the practices of bhakti and the association of devotees, very quickly we develop faith. Nobody has to come and tell us that now you have to believe this or else. You see, or else you're a sinner. This is called fanaticism. That is religion without philosophy. So our philosophy is experiential. You know, our religious experience, in other words, the philosophy that we're learning is based on experience. See, so there is a wonderful marriage of religion and philosophy. Lord Krishna says in the ninth chapter, Rajavidya Rajaguhyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyak Sarvagamam Dharmyam Shushukam Kartamavayam. That this knowledge is the king of education. Why? Because it's more technical? No. Because it's more believable? No. Because it gives direct perception of the self by realization. Therefore, it's the perfection of religion. And it is everlasting and joyfully performed. So it's the happiness that we experience that makes us attracted, isn't it? It's the really kind of indescribable happiness of being in the association of devotees. It is a great privilege to be in the association of devotees. It's a great liberation to be in the association of devotees. You know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would sometimes exclude people from association who had improper attitudes or behavior. So that automatically, the taste of being in Vaishnava Sangha makes us be on our best behavior if we are appreciating the experience, right? What's the first offense to the holy name? Exactly, to blaspheme the devotees who've dedicated their life. Is there any offense for blaspheming the non-devotees? No, I mean, just turn on CNN. It is a nonstop flood of blasphemy of non-devotees. This one is blaspheming that one, and that one is blaspheming the other. And this is called an election. You know? Everybody is critical. So the association of devotees is an entirely different affair. You know, in the Rasalila pastimes of Lord Krishna, they begin with this wonderful incident. The Lord's playing the flute, and all the gopis hear the flute. So all the gopis drop whatever they're doing and run to Krishna. And what are they thinking? What's that? What do they want? They want to be with Krishna. Do they want to be with a crowd in Krishna? They want to be alone with Krishna. Right, that's why they're dropping, okay, there's no time to waste. I got to go right now and beat the crowd. It's like trying to leave work at 3:30 so you beat rush hour, you know. They know everyone's going to come running to the sound, so let me get there first. But they, with this desire, they all come to Krishna, wanting to be alone with Krishna. And Krishna is there, and he charms them all, and he entertains them all, and enlivens them all. And then they start thinking, we are the most fortunate women in the universe. And then what does Krishna do? He disappears. As soon as they get a little proud, then he's gone. So then they meet this one gopi who managed to be alone with Krishna. They could tell by the crime scene investigation. They found the footprints. And here are two sets of footprints. And then here's where the footprints stop and the toes become deeply impressed. Oh, Krishna was reaching up here to get some flowers for his beloved. And then they follow a little further, and all of a sudden, Krishna's footprints disappear. And then they find Radharani. And what happened? And then she says, oh, I was thinking that Krishna has left all the other gopis just for me. And the moment she became proud, and feeling this way, she said, oh, Krishna, carry me over here. I'm very tired. And Krishna says, okay, get on my shoulders. And he turns around, and he's gone. So then the gopis, together with Radharani, they're very sympathetic for Radharani. They're all feeling very morose in separation from Krishna, which is actually a great ecstasy. But externally, it's great sadness. And they follow deeper into the forest, but it gets too dark, they can't see, so they go back to the river and they just start singing the glories of Krishna like one, as one, see? And then what happens? What happens when they're all together feeling Krishna returns to them? Yes. And then what does Krishna do? Yeah, he dances with each one of them individually. So the thing that they wanted at the beginning of the night, they got when they came together in association. And each gopi was thinking, oh, Krishna's dancing with me alone, which is just what their desire was to start. So we can learn so much from this. When devotees come together to please Krishna, then Krishna is very attracted to be present. Just one devotee is thinking, oh, Krishna's all about me and I'm all about Krishna. That's it. And the rest of them, who cares? You know, this does not attract Krishna. And so our big challenge is to learn to live nicely in the association of devotees. It is imperative that we can treat other devotees with the proper respect. It is imperative to appreciate other devotees, even if they have different views. Now, this is also related to the subject of fanaticism. We were talking the other day about niyamagraha, you know, the dual meaning word in the Nectar of Instruction that is listed as one of the causes of fall down. Niyamagraha and niyamagraha, that to either neglect the rules and regulations or follow them blindly. So to neglect the rules and regulations is like philosophy without religion. You know, arm's length. I'm studying this, but I don't have to apply it in my own life. And to follow the rules and regulations blindly, without regard to how other people may feel, that is religion without philosophy. So again, in the proper synthesis of philosophy and religion, we observe the rules and regulations, but we put the association of devotees above the rules and regulations. In other words, the way in which we are impacting other devotees is more important than just following the letter of the law. You see, that is, from my own experience, what I have seen many, many years in the association of devotees. I've been blessed to be in them. So far, Krishna hasn't kicked me out. Tendency is there. Some people will have this nature to want to very strictly follow the rules and regulations. And then in applying them very strictly, they will make other people feel bad. And that doesn't register with them, that maybe it's more important to treat the devotee in such a way that they feel encouraged and enlivened instead of discouraged and, like, you know, fallen. That is a symptom of a neophyte devotee, really. It's a neophyte thing. Just not getting it, not understanding that the personalism comes first. It's an impersonal application of the rules and regulations. And conversely, to think that I don't need to worry about the rules and regulations is another way of showing disrespect to the devotees. Because if somebody's in the association of devotees but not following the rules and regulations, then they're like a duck among swans? Is that the example? They're making a crow among swans, right? Making this obnoxious noise. And Krishna does not appreciate that. So what happens is such a person will lose attraction for the association of devotees. Say, I'd rather hang out with these people because they can relate to what I like to do. So they'll be attracted to some other association. Just as we're reading in this pastime, you know, Prabhupada writes that sometimes a devotee is placed in an awkward position by the arrangement of the Lord in order for a certain thing to happen. So if a devotee is somehow put in an awkward position, neophyte devotees will think, oh, this person, because he's fallen, he is, you know, getting his comeuppance, he's getting his karma. And, you know, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes, I take joy in the unhappiness of others, describing his mind. See, not that he does, actually, but this is how his mind is inclined. You know, he's a self-realized soul, so he sees this, and he doesn't act on it, but he says, this is what my mind is thinking. And when somebody else becomes happy, oh, then I become unhappy. Very deep, very deep. So my point is simply that in the association of devotees, if we value our experience in Krishna consciousness, we'll treat the devotees with respect. We'll treat them with deference. We'll give them the benefit of a doubt. And we'll avoid trying to find fault with them. This is a big offense. And it burdens us tremendously if we have this habit. So there's really no one who is responsible to find fault with others unless they happen to have that particular service. You know, to be a leader, sometimes you must be in a position to correct other people. But even that, you must know the art of doing it in such a way that the person feels encouraged to improve and not humiliated and discouraged. You know, for example, to criticize someone publicly is like the nuclear bomb of, you know, of corrections. I learned this in fundraising, in nonprofit fundraising. You know, because we don't, in nonprofit organizations, in most cases, or at least in many cases, you cannot fire people because they're volunteers. Yeah, you know, you cannot threaten to dock their salary. So you have to learn a different way of negotiating with people, with volunteers. And so the greatest reward you can give a volunteer is to recognize them publicly. And the stupidest thing you can do with a volunteer is to criticize them publicly. So in the event that we see somebody is doing something wrong, or at least we perceive that, then we should go through the proper authority. Okay? Otherwise, we're exercising fanaticism, religion without philosophy. I'll give you an example. I am a fanatic about using the morning melody for Mangal Arati. You all know that. I'm a fanatic because Prabhupada's secretary told me personally and also wrote about it. I'm a little musically inclined, so I can follow the melody, and I know not everybody is. And yes, the ceiling will not come crashing down if you don't use the morning melody for Mangal Arati, but it was Prabhupada's instruction. So if somebody's not using it, my skin starts crawling. Can't we learn this one simple melody? So many times I have to bite my tongue or chain myself to a chair or something just to refrain from screaming out, Prabhu! So in order to indulge my this particular eccentricity, I try to talk about it in istogostis and in general, right? Or if a person is just habitually not using it, I might pull them aside for an interrogation and say, do you know this melody? But I mean, the point is, there are ways to do it that can minimize the damage or avoid putting the person on the spot in the association of devotees. And so that is true with just about anything. You might see a new person eating with their left hand, and okay, you can jump all over, oh, Prabhu, that's an offense to prasadam. Don't you know the left hand is for this? You know, or you can say, okay, let's bring this up at istogosti. You know, in a way that is general, and that this person who's eating with his left hand won't feel singled out. So there's an art to instructing and to correcting and to following rules and regulations, and at the same time respecting the association of devotees. If everybody feels encouraged, then that is your success. If somebody feels discouraged, then you're a nonsense. Then you're acting fanatically. So how to keep everybody feeling encouraged? It takes a great deal of tolerance. Takes a great deal of broad-mindedness. This is, Prabhupada writes about this. The Brahmana means broad-minded. And what is the opposite? Kripana, a cripple-minded person. Very narrow perceptions. Okay, things have got to be this way or else they're not right. But the taste of bhakti is very broad-minded. It is for the most intelligent class. Yajanti hi sumedhasa. And to be intelligent means to get the most out of the experience that we're having in Krishna consciousness. Treating the devotees respectfully, relishing the pastimes that we're reading, having faith in them based on this relish and this taste, not based on blind following. That is intelligent application of Krishna consciousness. Any comments or questions?
This is like jaundice or like bitter in the beginning, and for a person who is suffering with a disease of jaundice. So how does it match with, like, at the same time we are experiencing taste, at the same time it's like a jaundice-like condition.
Right, for a person who has a jaundice-like condition of material life, how can they expect to get taste? And of course the answer is that when you have jaundice you can't taste sugar candy. But the cure for jaundice is sugar candy. So you have to eat the sugar that tastes bitter. Actually, it's not just you can't taste it, it tastes terrible. I haven't had jaundice, but I have a friend who went through it, and he said that's so true, it was shocking. And sweets tasted absolutely unbearably bad when he had jaundice. Anyone here had jaundice? Well, do you remember that experience? Diwaka? Foods don't taste the way they ordinarily do. So in spite of that, you have to eat or you don't get better, right? So when a new person comes to Krishna consciousness, they will find some of the things enjoyable and some of them objectionable. And if the objectionable list outweighs the enjoyable list, then they aren't ready to live in the association of devotees. That we have experienced over and over again. You know, But when somebody is advanced enough to say, wow, even though I have to get up early and even though I have to follow these principles, this is so much fun that I'll do it anyway. Anyone see Yadunath's horse race? You remember that? Yeah, so all the horses are competing. Anyway, you can't really describe it. You have to watch. But remember, one of the horses is named, boy, this is fun. Ah, but here comes that darn sex desire around the corner. So this is the process. Gradually we get better by eating the sweet. And when the food tastes sweet again, then we know we're cured of materialism. Right. Other comments or questions? Yes, Sureshwar Prabhu.
Sometimes folks in the Bible Belt say, how do I know? Well, the Bible tells me so. So how is that different? Because it sounds very simplistic.
Yes.
From our descending process of knowledge.
Right. The difference is that combination of philosophy and religion, that because I believe in this book, therefore I have a right to treat you in a condescending manner. I have a right to dismiss you as a heathen, to pigeonhole you without getting to know you, to write you off, to, in many ways disrespect you. So we see that very advanced Vaishnavas can mix with anybody and people will appreciate them. So the advanced devotee does not just come and say, the Bhagavad Gita says this, and I believe it, and so it's true. You know, Vridhananda Maharaj was talking about his experiences in the academic community, you know. And he said he realized that devotees have a tendency, very strong tendency, to say, well, Prabhupada said. But in the scholarly venue, or milieu, to say, well, my guru said, is, he said it sounds like a three-year-old saying, my daddy said. So that's just particularly in the academic community. But just in general, human interactions, if we say this sort of thing to people, well, I believe the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavad Gita says this, then this is equivalent to the ninth offense. Against the holy name, which is to preach to the faithless. In other words, they don't believe the Bhagavad Gita, but we're citing it anyway. See, it doesn't mean we can't quote the Bhagavad Gita, but we have to put it in terms that are relevant to their interests. And before we can do that, we have to understand their interests. So the actual competent and experienced presenter of Krishna consciousness will start by understanding the other person, because there's so much we can present. See, we're as opposed to just trying to hit them over the head with our shastra.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the principle is the same, but the way they apply it is completely fanatic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And this is because there is more of a negative emotion behind their faith than a positive one. They believe because they're afraid not to believe. They are trying to convert you because that will affirm their conversion. And there's no sweetness behind it. Rather, it's just fear. Better get yourself right with the Lord, you know, or else. So, and, you know, candidly, there's a lot of substance to that in the Bible. I mean, there's a lot of backup for that in the Bible. The last words of the Old Testament, the last phrase is, lest I smite the earth with a curse, you know, or else, God is saying. And it's basically the story, isn't it, his chosen people disobeying him and getting punished and disobeying him again and getting punished again. So there's a real sense of fear behind much of modern religion. Krishna consciousness, what does Prabhupada teach us to be afraid of? Yeah. You know, as a Christian, I learned how to be afraid of God and love Maya. And then Prabhupada taught me to love God and be afraid of Maya. So this is the difference. Other comments? That's Vaishnava Prabhu.
I also have read like many beautiful phrases about praising God and really trying to develop relationship with God in Bible itself. So maybe it's the Christians, the way they preach is not right, but Bible itself teaches love for God only. And also in Shastras we see like Lord Rama getting angry and saying, I'll destroy the whole world or things like that. The Christians don't really preach it properly, if that's my understanding. Otherwise, Bible is full of beautiful praises for God.
So the Bible has some beautiful praises of God, but they're rather vague. Yeah. And the Shastra has examples. Our Shastra has examples of God getting mad and threatening. Yeah, but not a lot. Not a lot. You know, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, we find that Krishna says, "Mahato bayats." A little advancement on this path will save one from the most dangerous type of fear. But this is not a threat, it's a choice. You see? In other words, we have the choice, we're given the choice in the Bhagavad Gita to use our human life or to lose it. To use it for developing God consciousness or to return to the animal species. So, that is more of a neutral description of reality than a threat. It's just more of a warning, right? And what he's advocating is not just a blind faith, that you just believe blindly. But at the end of the Gita, for example, Krishna says to Arjuna, now I have explained everything. Now, do what you wish to do. Yate chasi tata kuru. As my friend said, this is my favorite verse in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, now do whatever you want to do. So he doesn't threaten, he doesn't coerce. He just explains it and says, now you do what you wish. See, this is the difference. This is religion with philosophy as opposed to just religion. You better do it or else you're going to suffer. See? Yes, it's true that Lord Ram threatened the ocean. But that's the exception rather than the rule, isn't it? That's true. There are threats, but there's far more positive incentive, you know, and that's the basis. Bhakti is based on love. Okay.